Hey, it's Aman, and I'm joined by Rob Slick. Rob is the co-founder of Slick, a salon management SaaS tool. So if you're an owner of a hair and beauty salon, Slick helps you manage bookings, payments, website, and marketing. Now, I'm super excited for this episode because Slick have had a stellar growth journey. They have 2,000 plus customers, top four in market share, and are growing 100% year on year. Now, this is all fueled by their awesome product, which has an 85 NPS and less than 1% churn. So without further ado, let's kick it off. Welcome, Rob.
Hey man, thank you very much for having me. Yeah, lovely to be here.
Awesome. So let's kick it off. I may not have done a good job explaining Slick. In your words, can you tell me what Slick is, who you got, what you guys do, and your journey so far?
Yeah, no, you've done a great job. We work with independent, and that's probably the keyword here, SMB hair beauty barbers, which sort of sounds like a kind of a fairly uninteresting market, and it's the sort of conversation we have with a lot of investors. But ultimately, there are 55,000 of these businesses up and down the high street in the UK. What's interesting about our market is it's very much owner operator. If you look at so hotels, restaurants, that's where the chains dominate. In our market, 95% of businesses have less than, I think, seven staff and are independent sites, owner operator. So you're selling to the high street. We've got no interest in working with the chains. There aren't that many of them. What we're really interested in is powering those small owner operator businesses that are kind of the living heartbeat of the British high street. And it's a sector that's seen so much growth in the last couple of years. In the 2008 recession, it was the only vertical that actually grew. All the other verticals went backwards. Hair and beauty went forwards. It's commonly understood that you have this thing called the lipstick effect, where even in times of hardship, predominantly women, but also now increasingly men, they will sacrifice pretty much everything in order to maintain their beauty regimes. They will trade down their choice of food, their choice of restaurants, but they will, if you've been buying Chanel lipstick, you will go through everything to maintain buying that Chanel lipstick. That's what makes you feel good. And in tough times, people continue to spend on beauty. We've seen it in the last couple of years. So it's been a real kind of boom sector. Number of barbershops is up 50% in the last 5 years alone. So it's been something we've been sort of super interested in. But what's really interesting about it is it's always been a sort of vertical that has been very analog. And whereas restaurants, hotels have digitized online booking, CRM systems are sort of an integral to their running day to day now. This is still a sector where 60% of businesses still use old-fashioned pen and paper. And that's the sort of the problem we're solving. We're giving them accessible tech that they can use, that's intuitive, that really runs their entire business. So I always think of it, if it moves in a barber shop, we touch it, whether that be bookings, payments, inventory control, CRM, analytics, data protection, wages, payroll, HR. We're that kind of one-stop platform that really allows these creatives, and they are creatives. They've gone into hairdressing or barbering because they love this, the creative side of it and the people side of it. We basically take all their admin off them and allow them to get back to doing what they love doing, which is cutting hair, delivering an amazing customer experience, and we essentially fuel all of the nuts and the bolts of their business and allow them to crack on with it.
That's super cool. I didn't know such interesting stats about how recession proof it is, let's say.
Yeah.
This is a bit off the cuff, but I'm very curious about like that market in specific. So you said there's 55,000 barbers. Like, I don't know, for example, like how much does a barber turn over every year? Of those 55K, like how many of them can actually buy your product or take your product on? Like, what's that actual market size of this opportunity?
yeah so a lot of these are SME businesses, so a lot of them are for VAT, for tax reasons, they operate under the VAT threshold. And whether that be through legitimate means or legitimate is a moot point, one we won't maybe discuss today. But you've got a variety of sizes. Like the average business that we sort of work with is turning over around 100K. And in terms of kind of addressability across those sort of 55,000 sites, which is across hair, beauty, barbering, we reckon we've probably got kind of 80 to 85% kind of product market fit. I know you're going to come on to it, but our kind of partnership with L'Oreal has meant that we've focused a little bit more on the hairdressing sector than the beauty sector. So there's certain things that we haven't really built out yet that we know we need to build out to really go deeper into the beauty vertical. Barbering, we've got a pretty good kind of product market fit for. They've all got their own kind of unique requirements as sectors as to what they need their software to do, the way they set their businesses up, the way they operate. And I guess what's important for us is to make sure we really understand those, build features, products that actually work for those sectors. And that's where we're really strong, is actually being really close to our customers. And I guess that you mentioned our kind of our referral rate, our lack of churn, our NPS. And I guess all of those points that I guess get the testament to just how close we are to the customer and how much we've built a product that really works for that sector.
Interesting. Cool. And to follow on from that, I think you mentioned like a couple specific parts of like the hair and beauty sector. So you said like hairdressing, and you said salon. I'm now thinking of like nail parlors, massage parlors. Are these like all like sitting just outside your ICP, and they're like the next layers of what you're going to target, or where do they sit in the hair and beauty sector?
Yeah, so nails is in there. It's not something we deliberately really focus on. I guess customer kind of life expectancy, if you will, for a typical nail salon is actually a lot lower than hair, beauty or barbering. So churn rates are higher there. Typically, a lot of those are cash businesses, so they're very keen not to digitize. So it's a small part of the market that we don't really focus on. There's enough hair barbers to be going around. So at some point we'll probably get to nail salons. Massage parlors, sunbeds, all of that is, again, it's on the periphery. We've got a few people that use us who are in those verticals. And we've got all sorts. We've got dog grooming parlors, we've got tattooists, we've got chiropractors, estheticians. Wow. It's what we've built is an incredibly flexible platform that if you are taking bookings and clients are paying for those bookings, broadly we can work with you. Are we building out a business specifically for tattoo parlors? No. We're very much hair, beauty, barbering. But if you're running appointments, you can pretty much use our system. But we've gone vertical specific as opposed to kind of that breadth, which is where you've got the Calendly's of the world, Appointed, Acuities, where you have a very broad sort of scheduling system, which really works for anybody that's taking appointments, whatever business. They maybe don't have the vertical specific features that we have in terms of addressing pain points for the kind of the hair and beauty industries.
Cool. Super interesting. I feel like a bit more nailed down on the ICP. You mentioned L'Oreal. So let's go into L'Oreal. So what is your relationship with L'Oreal? And can you then explain how that helped you do whatever you're doing?
Yeah. So my co-founder, Steph, she actually had she was looking at this of the sector. She'd worked on the Just Eat IPO, was looking at how tech had disrupted legacy analog high street businesses, and her attention turned to hair. And she actually got in touch with Founders Factory, this is the London incubator accelerator, who had a corporate partnership with L'Oreal. And it was actually at that same time that L'Oreal were having a conversation with Founders Factory of, our industry is actually not particularly digitized. There's huge opportunities that are going missing in terms of CRM data, that digital client journey, and we as an industry are at risk of being left behind. Other industries are starting to kind of push forward in terms of that digital experience. That's taking share of wallet away from our industry. And so we need to be equipping the industry with the right tools to be growing. And that ultimately is a booking system. It's the CRM and it's the analytics, which allows that digital customer journey, allows those efficiencies. And so L'Oreal were quite keen to invest in a startup that was looking at that sector. And that's really where Slick came to be born, was a marriage of L'Oreal's desire to innovate, Steph's view on that this is something that the consumers need, and so Founders Factory really acting as that matchmaker. And then my experience was I'd spent 7 years at L'Oreal, so I understood the sector incredibly well. I'd worked as a marketeer. I'd seen the pain points of that analog customer journey from a marketeer's perspective. Are you unable to run digital campaigns? You're not sure what's converting. You're not sure where the traffic's going. And if you can equip your network with this platform, you can then actually, you've got better conversion points because everyone's been equipped with online booking, you've got better data, you've got better analytics, you can then see what retention rates are, you can then analyze the business. And so that's really where Slick came from.
Sweet, awesome. And then in terms of fundraising, what's the story there?
Yeah, so we, as part of that, conversation with L'Oreal invested into our kind of a pre-seed round. So they gave us the initial capital to get the business up and running. And I guess what we've had to build is really a full stack sort of CRM system that touches absolutely everything. So it's a pretty complex product. You're taking bookings, you're taking deposits with those bookings. You then got to record that deposit, both in terms of sort of cash flow on the client's profile. In reports, you've then got all these moving parts. So it's a complex beast, but because you're giving this on an iPad to your typical owner who's 50, 60, has been using pen and paper for 20 years, you've got to wrap that in a UI that is incredibly intuitive, incredibly simple to use. You're not selling into enterprise clients here. So it's a lot of, it requires a lot of capital to get it up and get an MVP up and running. So L'Oréal really provided that, but also provided a huge amount of insight into, well, look, how they see the market, what they think the market needs. And it was an interesting kind of, it started to bring up interesting tensions, because actually you then start to get into a point where, and this is, I guess, a big learning for us as working with a corporate, of, well, what the corporate wants isn't necessarily what their end customer wants. And so actually we were starting to have those sort of slightly more challenging conversations of where they think what the customer wants is a full stack, essentially a HubSpot for a salon, where you've got MailChimp, you've got all of these wonderful email builders, and you're having to explain this. Well, your typical owner is 60. They don't want that. They can't use that. But also, if they're going to accept and take on a platform such as this, you can have the best email campaign tool in the world, but ultimately it's got to have cash up, it's got to have booking functionality, it needs to be able to take deposits, payments, you've got to do stock control, a lot of fairly unglamorous things that are real kind of hygiene considerations before they switch and take on a CRM. And so it was a really interesting learning about being able to understand and being able to pitch back to the corporate of, look, this is what your customers are saying they want. This is why we need to build that, which is the right thing for us as a business, the right thing for you as for your customers. But it means that actually what you want as a corporate, we can't deliver that now. We can deliver that in 1 year's time, 2 years' time, further down the line. And actually being able to get them to understand why the product roadmap needs to be a certain way. Because I think there are certain times when we were pushed to be developing certain features that sounded great, but ultimately they weren't going to be onboarding salons, because ultimately they were blocked by other more kind of basic hygiene factors that really the corporate L'Oréal didn't really, why would they know that that customer needs that? It's of no interest to them, it's no use to them as a corporate. So it was a really interesting journey, but they've massively helped with the go-to-market. Obviously having that name attached to you in the space is hugely credible. No other sort of software has had that investment, has got that sort of that partnership. So obviously that really helps us sort of stand out in a fairly crowded marketplace.
Cool. And so out of those conversations where you're debating on features and roadmap, like, is it sort of say you have to educate L'Oréal on why it should be this way, and then eventually like you go with your version of what you want to do? Or is there still a bit of like, okay, we have to do it half and half, if that makes sense, because we still need to appease the corporate investor who ultimately wants to do something else with this down the line, I assume.
Yeah, there was a certain amount of funding that was ring-fenced for test and learns that would were then helping their sort of global teams and their UK team. But ultimately, you had to keep pulling it back to, if we are going to collectively achieve what we want to achieve, which is to digitalize this sector, this is the empirical data we've got of, this is what your customers want. They want a system that is going to manage inventory control. They want a system that can sell vouchers. Selling vouchers, does that really help L'Oréal sell more tubes of color? No, not really. But ultimately, that's a hygiene factor that they need for them to take on the platform. Once they've taken on the platform, they can then start to use all the marketing tools, which is then going to drive more repeat bookings, more spend. That is then going to ultimately impact your sales in, whether that be bottles of shampoo, tubes of color, whatever. It's playing that long game. And I think that's the bit that I guess we had to get across, was this is an investment. This isn't going to increase your sales in six months' time. This is something that is going to take time, because we've got to build a hell of a lot of features in order to get product market fit. Once we get product market fit, we can then start to actually positively impact your business, your partners. That's positively going to impact your business, but that takes time.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And so you mentioned Founders Factory as well. So you went through, is it an incubator, is it an accelerator? I can't remember the exact definition of it. So you went through this journey. Tell us about that, and how did that work with L'Oreal involved as well? Because that's quite a unique medley of people, let's say.
Yeah, so we were startup number one. So we were part of their studio, so their incubator program. And I think incubators provide you with a huge amount of access, both in terms of fundraising, amazing accesses into investors. They can really help, and they helped us, or helped Steph hire our CTO, Matt. So providing those introductions into the world of tech, where Steph and I were both first-time founders, so we didn't have that sort of that network to call on, is hugely helpful. I think where my learning from working with an incubator is that they will have a pathway to success for certain business models. And typically D2C, they're very well versed in D2C, enterprise sales, SMB SaaS sales. There's not many people doing it. And yeah. I think what we found quite interesting was a lot of this of advice and the kind of the playbooks that we were getting were very much, well, actually, that's something that works for enterprise, or that's something that is very much a product-led growth roadmap. Again, we don't think this is right for our business model and for our market. And I think what the secret was actually learning which bits of advice to ignore and learning which bits of advice of actually, yeah, that's great. And you would sort of, we were finding ourselves actually, you're picking a bit of a playbook from an enterprise sales playbook, which actually for our kind of, for our TAM, for our sort of ARPU, you might sort of almost throw away and go, well, that shouldn't really work. And actually the unit economics don't necessarily work for that. But ultimately, if that's what is needed to onboard those customers and you can make the unit economics work, then yeah, why not try it? You're then picking up a piece of an idea from another company in the incubator kind of program. It's very much going for product-led growth. Yep, that will also work. And it's just trying to sort of take bite-sized chunks from all of the advice they've got, because there's so much advice out there. But ultimately, you need to be the one that can kind of work it out and work out what's going to work for your market and your customer. And that's your role as a founder. I think the danger is that you can look at those studios as they're going to give you all of the answers. Here's a ready-made playbook. Just follow it to execute it and you're going to be successful. It doesn't work like that. You've got to be the one that kind of just picks and chooses those bits of advice, because there's so much out there.
Cool. I want to dive into this more, but I want to also clarify for the listeners exactly like what your go-to-market is. So correct me if I'm wrong and I'll explain it. You effectively have field reps going around, going into barber shops and beauty salons, having conversations and selling on a one-to-one basis, which is typically a very enterprise sale where they sell, you know, 20K, 30K, 100K ACV. But in this scenario, you don't have 100K ACV. So you're selling a much cheaper product with the exact same mechanism that a Salesforce is using, and they're just about making their numbers work. But you're somehow doing that at much smaller margins. Like, maybe just explain a bit like how you've got this go-to-market, which ultimately I don't think I've heard much of from like a strategic perspective.
So I guess it came about from a couple of sort of standpoints. One is actually if you look at the numbers, you look at search intent for the category, search intent's low. Category consideration is low. There's a reason that 65% of salons are still on pen and paper.
Mm.
And so if you're purely relying on a digital go-to-market, yeah, you're going to pick up some of the market, but there's a lot of the market that just, they're simply not looking for your solution. And they're very embedded in their traditional ways of working. It works for them. Yeah, it's chaos. And yes, they'd like a solution, but they're just not looking for it. And so one of our early investors and advisors is ex-Just Eat.
Cool.
And Just Eat actually had a similar kind of challenge. And their solution was a town-by-town approach. They went town-by-town and they would go and win 20, 30% market share in a town. They would then move on. And once they'd moved on, all of the other people that weren't using Just Eat were then looking around going, well, why am I not using it? Because everyone else has got this door sticker. And we're the same. they all know each other. They all went to college together. They all go to the same wholesaler together. They go on the same training courses together. They all talk. And so, yes, they're in competition, but it's very much a friendly competition. And so they're checking each other out. Like, why has so-and-so got a book now button on their Instagram? Why are they now offering online booking? Who's this Slick company that's then powering their online booking? And you start to then, once you get traction in those little kind of markets, you then start to see that referral mechanism kick in. But ultimately, these businesses, it's the example I always give is, and it's funny, you use Salesforce. Nobody likes moving from Salesforce to HubSpot, HubSpot to Pipedrive, Pipedrive to Salesforce, whatever it might be. Moving your booking system to Salesforce is exactly the same. Mm. And so, yes, we have to invest in terms of our CAC to get these customers across. But once they're across, they're incredibly sticky. And these businesses are typically sticking around for 10, 15 years. Cool. So your LTV can actually be pretty sizable. Then when you start to then layer on the payments opportunity, everything else that we can do for them, you can make a pretty compelling subset of unit economics as to why a kind of more of an enterprise sales cycle actually works. And so whilst we have COVID was very interesting for us, it was one of the big challenges that we've probably experienced, but it did actually reset people's expectations of actually, no, I can conduct business over Zoom. So we don't have to spend as much time going into salon for demos or training anymore. We can do that online, Zoom, Google Meets, et cetera. So that's worked quite well for us. We've massively invested in the SDR sort of function. And so that's paying real dividends. And then as you mentioned right at the start, we get a fairly healthy kind of inbound volume purely just from so peer-to-peer referrals of, look, I hate my current software. It's expensive. It's clunky. It's really old. Who are you using? What do you love? And we get name checked pretty much every single time. And that's, you mentioned this, a product people love, but I think it's also, we've really doubled down on our kind of customer support, customer success teams to provide our customers with not only a sort of a community that they can, where they can sort of connect with other owners, but also a support function where a lot of these people are, they're almost accidental business owners. They got given the keys to a salon age 25 when their dad retired. And yeah, they're brilliant cutters, they're brilliant colorists, but they've never had a formal business education. That's where we can step in and really coach them and help them. And so, yes, the product's sticky, but it's actually what you're giving around the product that really helps cement that relationship. And that's it's one of the big fundamental drives of that NPS score and that churn score.
Cool. I really like that. That was interesting. Like my key takeaways from that piece was like, there's like a critical mass you have to hit in a certain area before the referrals start coming in. And and the fact that your LTV is like ridiculously long. So therefore that makes up the fact that you're not selling a 20K ACV over 1 year, but you're selling it over like 5 years. So that's why it all backs out correctly.
Exactly.
And then once you hit the critical mass, the referrals just drop your CAC massively because everyone that comes in is just the denominator bringing it all down.
Yeah. And cool. So even when you might not, that might not necessarily present itself in an inbound lead, but actually you've got critical mass. So actually when you're reaching out into that area, you're then able to name check, well, we work with X, Y, Z. Oh, okay, didn't realize that. Suddenly I've got credibility. Suddenly I'm now slightly worried that my competition is stealing a march from me because they're now innovating, they're now doing something different. And so even though you might have you've got some cost of acquisition there, your cost of acquisition is still kind of depressed because you're able to actually shorten that sales cycle.
That's awesome. That's so interesting. I imagine it took you time to get to that model. I mean, you said like you went through like different go-to-market and all this advice. Like, tell me that journey of like, what did you try before you found out, okay, look, it's the SDR approach that attacks it like an enterprise, but sells to the SMB. Like, I'm guessing you tried multiple things before. What was that journey like?
Yeah, we did. I mean, we did and we didn't. We invested when we first started. We invested very heavily in paid. You look at the paid search numbers. What's challenging for us is a lot of our competition will run 5-year contracts, and they're operating much more of an enterprise price point. So what they're perhaps willing to pay in terms of bid terms is very different to what we're willing to do in terms of more of an SMB approach. But also the volumes just aren't really there. Paid social works well. But I think what I took from my L'Oreal days was that business functions on relationships, on having somebody that knows their territory, knows the various owners, can name drop that I'm working with this person. Yeah, we're working with that person. And so pretty early on, we adopted almost that sort of that L'Oreal field sales approach. And we ran that for a good couple of years. And essentially it was an AE type role, but who was also responsible for generating their own leads. It was only really in the last couple of years that we then actually started to bolt on the SDR approach and actually gain more speciality of, look, we've got people who are exceptional at booking demos, generating interest, and we've then got some exceptional people who are great at then doing that demo. Our demo conversion rate is north of 70%. They then train them, they then hand them on to a customer success team, and you've then got a really sort of smooth onboarding cycle for that customer. But also that works really well from us as an internal point of view in terms of making sure everyone's got their own niche and getting people that are really, really good at that rather than trying to have people that are too generalist.
Sweet. Awesome. Let's go through your setbacks. Let's go through like the bad points, because we've had a good conversation. And there's a lot of SaaS founders listening to this, so obviously like maybe they're in a pickle, they're trying to work out what to do, and they kind of want to have a bit of awareness of it's not all rosy until you get to that point. So tell me about the biggest setbacks you've had in that journey and where you've struggled.
I mean, I think if you were to say to us, would you found a business that operates on the high street prior to COVID, energy in price increase, war in Ukraine, cost of living crisis, etc. Yeah, no, you'd never do that. So yeah, it certainly hasn't been all rosy. I think COVID was a real challenge because we were much smaller. We were much more in our infancy back then. And so whilst we had a good couple of hundred customers, we were revenue generating. We were at that point where we didn't have huge amounts of cash runway. But ultimately, you've got salons that are shut. And that was where we don't do contracts. We run just a monthly rolling subscription with pure SaaS. Suddenly, it's one of the easy things for you to cut. And so we had to work pretty hard to make sure we didn't really lose a lot of our business. So we really doubled down on what can we strip out of the platform, but yet still be revenue generating. But this is where it was our first foray really into, I guess, what you and I would call content, but what they would kind of call education. And so with them being closed, we really looked at, well, what can we do to support them? And so actually our product team started to really work on features and tools that were going to help them to reopen. So we could then start to talk about, right, when we cut, this is going to end. Yes, it looks doom and gloom now, but there will be an ending. Here are the tools and the playbooks that you need for when you reopen. So don't think about cancelling your subscription because you're going to need these tools. But then with everyone sitting around not able to cut hair or colour, okay, well, how can we help our customers? And so we got one of our team really into content creation and basically producing webinars, short videos on how to think about your business. And again, how to set your business up for success. So when you reopen, what's your customer CRM going to look like? Who are you going to be contacting first? How are you going to operate a wait list? What should you do about pricing? You know, people haven't had a haircut. I mean, I don't know whether you remember it, but we didn't have haircuts for 6 months.
Yeah, I remember I got my haircut in the garden and I went very bold very quickly.
Exactly. And so like, you've got, are you going to offer discounts? No, of course you're not, because you're in demand. And so actually we were able to kind of build out a community of people actually quite reliant on us for advice, education, but then also, build out that, so those features that they were going to need on reopening. So coming out of COVID, we actually had some of our best sales months, because I think people realized the challenges of operating a business, either on legacy software that's not cloud-based. And so, you've got your computer in the salon that's 10 miles away, but you can't access it because you don't have remote access. That's a challenge. Or if you're on pen and paper, how do I contact all my clients who are in a Rolodex to tell them that I'm open now? So we actually saw kind of, whilst it was really challenging and incredibly stressful, we saw a kind of real boom in terms of inbound and activations post-COVID. And so it's definitely changed people's mindsets around kind of the need to digitize and the role that technology plays. So that was certainly a challenge. I think this is, the cost of living crisis. Obviously, we work with small businesses. It's an incredibly energy intensive sector. Think hair dryers, lighting, heating. So that's certainly had an impact, but a lot of it is really actually reaffirming to these business owners that they're doing well, that our sector is in demand. You look at the footfall analysis, you look at the spend from clients, it's going up every year. As Britons, we are spending more and more on well, certainly female hair and beauty, but certainly male in the last couple of years. Men are spending way more of their disposable income on their personal appearance. And so it's almost trying to share these macro, this macro data that you or I might see in the FT or Economist or whatever, but almost trying to distill that down to your average barbershop and going, hey, look, you might be having a rough day and the barbershop might be a bit quiet, but actually look, we as an industry in a really good place. Here are the things that you need to be doing to boost your business. Here's how we can help you. And you, we've got a real kind of educational role within the industry and helping people sort of understand where they're at and what they can do to kind of to benefit from the consumer trends that ultimately are they are real kind of tailwinds for us, which is great.
Super cool. I think like from a marketing hat on my side, like I've seen, let's say the best SaaS companies at marketing are the ones that can attribute, that can link their tool to revenue growth for their client in some form. And so it sounds like when you had COVID come and you were like, cool, I can now speak about how you guys can make more money. And it doesn't even have to be related to Slick at all. It can just be like, hey, next try to get customers to pay for the next cut in advance and give them these like ideas and these tools. And I remember ClickFunnels doing it, Unbounce doing it, like every landing page builder, every CRO tool, are always able to link their tool back into revenue. And it sounds like once you crack that, you just have so much attention coming into your platform.
Well, I think it swaps the narrative from software as a cost to software as a profit center. And it's something that we as so we talk to the sales teams and try to talk to our customers the whole time of and the ones that really get it generally get it, the ones where we fall down and we're not as successful as we should be, is where that messaging does break down and it's still viewed as a cost. And it's like, no, this is going to salons are selling time. If you've booked out 2 hours for an appointment, that client doesn't turn up, you're not going to fill that slot. You're not going to get somebody who just walks in off the street and goes, oh, I've just happened to got 2 hours today to sit in the chair. You're not going to get that time back. That's gone. So you need to make sure that slot is filled. You've got a booking there and that booking turns up. And so it's really drilling back down to, as you said, the revenue basics of we can make an impact on your business. I mean, the typical revenue growth one of our customers sees is 25% within the first 6 months. Like it's genuinely jaw-dropping the impact you can have on these businesses. And that is one of the big reasons that I do it, because you are able to help these small business owners go from being pretty stressed to literally running around, managing hand to mouth, to suddenly they're operating really highly kind of efficient businesses, making really good money. I mean, we've got one customer who they've gone from 5 members of staff to 3 members of staff. So they've cut their overheads by approximately a third, I think it is. And yet they make 100% more revenue because they're full. They've priced up, every single slot's full. They just run a really efficient business. And you see the impact that has on their lifestyle, et cetera. It's amazing.
Amazing. Amazing. Cool. I think we're nearly there. So I want to run a quick fire section. So I got four
Sure.
questions. Let's kick it off. So the first one is, what's a book recommendation you'd give to another SaaS founder?
Great question. It's a bit, I mean, I'm sure you hear all of the cliches here, so I'm sure I won't be the first to say this. For me, it's one that I read a few years ago. It's Matthew Syed, Black Box Thinking. And the reason I say that is I came from a corporate background. And in corporates, you follow a formula. You're trained as an FMCG marketer to, there's almost a sort of a set way of launching a product. You go through these steps. If you do this, you're going to be broadly kind of correct. And the whole organization is geared to sort of to think in that way. I think as a founder coming in, if you try to follow what other people have done, you're not going to stand out. And it can be very dangerous to sort of to obsess about your competitors and what else is doing. You have to think differently. You've got to work out, well, why hasn't this problem been solved? What does the customer want? And really try to be that kind of that have that independent critical thought process that allows you to challenge things and to work out what's the right thing to do. And yeah, it's a great book about thinking differently and not following the norm and not being a sheep, so to speak. And it's certainly something that I kind of, yeah, I think about quite a lot. And I think it's probably one of my sort of strengths as a founder is that ability to sort of to think differently, think critically.
It sounds like you had to unlearn a lot, even though you had a lot of good learnings coming through your background.
Yeah, you do. I think you probably do, and it gives you great training. There's some great stuff that I still use for my FMCG days, but equally you've got to operate in a very different manner when you're especially when you're a first time founder in SaaS.
Amazing. Which entrepreneur or business leader do you admire the most, and why?
I thought about this a lot. This is maybe we might not have heard this one before. I'm actually going to say my grandfather.
Nice.
My great great grandfather founded a furniture interior design business in Hertfordshire, Essex, where I grew up, and so my grandfather sort of ran it and was responsible for a lot of the expansion of the business. And sadly, it didn't sort of survive the 2008 recession. He'd passed on by that point. But that sort of, I just remember growing up, and I guess probably what inspired me to run my own business. But I remember growing up, and it was just the most amazing kind of business of his focus on the customer and delighting the customer experience. They all knew him by name. He had an interest in them. He really wanted to deliver and really help them. That coupled with a real love of the product, and as a furniture retailer, selecting the right products, delivering an amazing quality of service, such high standards. And those two kind of facets coupled with he put so much energy and love into his team. And at his funeral, you had his secretary that had been there for 20, 30 years there. You had hundreds of people there who he'd worked with. And I think if you can really focus on your customer, you can obsess about your product, and you can build an amazing team and really kind of pour all your energy into the team and really sort of inspire them, treat them as humans. I think so many kind of businesses think about customers as to be, we talk about targeting customers and opportunities, and we always look at, we exploit them. He was brilliant. He just wanted to help his customers. And if you help your customers build a great product and help your team, you're going to build a great business. I just think it was in my sort of formative years, it was probably a real inspiration for me. And I suppose I think back to a lot of what he did, and he probably wasn't doing it in a formulaic and really thought about it. That's just what he was naturally doing. But he was great at it.
Amazing. It sounds like he blended life and work in a very meaningful manner.
Yeah, he was a great inspiration to me, and in some ways I wish that I could have taken on that business. It's the stars didn't align, because I think it would have been a great business to have run. But certainly, I think I hopefully have learned a lot from him.
Amazing. What SaaS tool do you use that potentially nobody else knows about yet?
surely this is almost the impossible question. I'd love to hear some of the other answers.
Yeah.
I probably won't break any, break any ground with saying this, but maybe we've just discovered a tool called High Touch, which essentially allows you to plumb in customer data from. So we use it for plumbing, basically from Google Sheets, which takes a lot of our data from our back end, and we can then plumb that with no code. Able to do it in a few hours, we can plumb that into our CRM. CRMs plural. You can plumb it into email builders. Really, really simple, absolutely amazing tool that typically to have run all of the API integrations to our tech team would have taken weeks and weeks and weeks, and I was able to do it in a couple of hours. If fueling your CRM tools with data is a challenge, then it's certainly worthwhile looking at that, because it certainly allowed us to get much tighter in some of our marketing, much of our customer success teams, building out lists where people need our help, flagging opportunities, flagging risks in a much more kind of systematic and organized fashion.
Amazing. Cool. And then finally, what's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
I'm going to slightly adjust the question of this is the best piece of advice I wish I'd received, but never did. Obviously, look, if you're late in your career, it's maybe a bit too late. If you're not, and there's anyone listening who's early on in their career, I genuinely think if you have the opportunity to work in sales and try to master it. Because for me, I think as a founder, sales is absolutely everything. Obviously, look, we are a, yeah, we're as we've gone through our go-to-market, sales is a big part of that. But ultimately, fundraising is sales. You're selling yourself, you're selling your business. Customer support is sales. You're trying to understand somebody's mindset and their problem. And you might have a solution, you might not have the solution that they want, but you need to sell them a slightly alternative solution, a workaround, a hack. You might have to slightly disappoint them, but you need to try and make that up for them. Customer success is sales. Everything is sales. Your HR, you're building relationships, you're trying to sell people opportunities. We have to persuade and influence people all the time. And that really is the sort of the crux of sales. And I think if you've got that opportunity to work in sales, it's such a great learning environment for you. That then gives you a load of skills that you can then use way down your career in loads of other facets. So yeah, for me, I think if you can get the opportunity to get in sales, go and work in sales, because it'll teach you so much.
I love that. I love that. My first job was cold calling mid-market private equity firms. And I just always come back to that moment of just a formative years, just learning how to get on the call, have no ego,
yep,
and just hustle for like 5 hours straight and just get rejected,
yep,
consistently.
Yep.
But then you learn so much.
Exactly. And it's, I think sales often gets a bit of a bad rep and you're like,
no way.
I remember I had the opportunity in my grad scheme of like, do you want to go into marketing or sales? Like, oh, marketing sounds way more fun. Like that's where all the smart people work. That's where all the cool stuff is. And yeah, it was great. But I think actually, yeah, what I could have learned from sales in terms of the economics of the business, the financials of the business, that is so much you learn there. That yeah, I think it's a great starting point.
Amazing. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. If someone wants to reach out to you, what's the best way they can do that?
Yeah, LinkedIn. Rob Smith. So LinkedIn, RWP Smith, you'll find me. Rob@getslick.com. So yeah, obviously, I'm very happy to talk to other sort of SaaS founders, fintech founders, talk payments, talk SaaS, talk go to market, whatever. If I can help in any way and I can share any of the mistakes that we've made, then more than happy to help out.
Amazing. Thank you so much. So thank you everyone for watching, and we'll call it there. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thanks, man.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thanks for sticking around. If you want to see the show notes, please go to neoptima.com/SaaS podcast. Otherwise, see you at the next episode. Bye.